So before the break, we looked at the Four Noble Truths in brief, which, of course, the Four Noble Truths is the very first teaching that the Buddha gave after achieving enlightenment. He gave this in a place called Sarnath, very close to Varanasi. And we use the analogy of a curable physical illness to understand these Four Noble Truths and how they fit together. So what I'd like to do now is just briefly go into each of these Four Noble Truths in a little bit more detail. And then I'd like to go on to talk about another set of teachings that the Buddha gave in a place called Rajgir after that. So the first noble truth, of course, is the truth of suffering, which is a translation of the Sanskrit word dukkha, which again is part of the Buddha's diagnosis. Basically, what is our current condition? What condition do we find ourselves in now? And this is a very good example of how simply the terminology can create confusion. Because again, this word suffering for us, when we see that, normally that for us, we relate that to unpleasant, painful physical and mental experiences. Whereas this word dukkha has a much more broader meaning of that. So let's try to understand what this word dukkha really means. And what we're going to see later in the Lam Rim text is there are a number of presentations to help us to understand this condition of dukkha that we find ourselves in. One of those that I find particularly helpful to understand what dukkha really means is what's called the three types or three levels of dukkha. The first is what's called the dukkha of suffering. So here, this is what we understand the word suffering to mean. It means that here it's talking about unpleasant, painful physical and mental experiences. So of course, this is part of our human condition. Sometimes, in fact, we do have suffering, painful experiences. We have unpleasant physical and mental experiences. This one we can relate to quite well, and this one we can really understand that these sorts of experiences are not very satisfactory. That's something we want to overcome. Then we have a presentation of the dukkha of change. And here the Buddha is describing our pleasant experiences. And normally we equate our pleasant experiences with happiness. But here the Buddha used the word change to describe our pleasant experiences. So why would he use the word change to describe our pleasant experiences?
Because they turn into their opposite if you pursue them too far?
Yeah, but even just less than that.
People, it changes kind of unsettling.
Because you're going to pursue that, and it's going to change you into whatever, following your pleasure thing? No?
Because it's temporary.
Because it's temporary. Very simple. Very simple. Is that all of our pleasant experiences are temporary, are transient. They're stimulus-based happiness. They require some stimulus. When the stimulus finishes, the happiness experience finishes. So this is at a simple level, what this word change means is that these pleasant experiences change, they finish, they come to an end, they're just transient, they're temporary. But also here, what we can understand with this word change is because these pleasant experiences are stimulus-based, they're unreliable. We can't just click our fingers and have a pleasant experience whenever we want one. If we don't have the stimulus, we don't have the pleasure. So they're unreliable. And not only that, but these pleasant experiences, which we normally see as happiness, are actually not in the nature of happiness. Because if an experience was in the nature of happiness, it would mean the more we engaged in that experience, the more happy we should become. But we know from our own experience that that's not the case. In fact, as mentioned here earlier, often it induces suffering. And the classic example that's often given in the text is, imagine that you're in a cold room and then you look outside, and well, not today, but you look outside and it's nice and warm and sunny, and you go, wow, that's so nice and sunny and warm out there. So we go out and we go, oh, so pleasant, so nice. But of course, if that experience is in the nature of happiness, it would mean the longer we sat in the sun, the more happy we should become. But we know from our own experience, if we sit in the sun too long, we get dehydrated, sunburned, and then often get too hot. And then we look back inside the room and go, oh, wow, so nice and cool in there. So what we can understand is that our pleasant experiences are relative experiences. Relative to a previous state, they're an improvement. But if we overindulge in these experiences, they often turn into suffering themselves. So this is also how we can sort of understand this change at a deeper level. And so remember, in the First Noble Truth, the Buddha said, dukkha is to be known. Now we don't know dukkha. Now we grasp at pleasant experiences as being happiness and we chase after them. Whereas here the Buddha is saying, understand your pleasant experiences for what they are. Understand that they're simply transient, temporary, pleasant experiences that are unreliable. They're not in the nature of happiness. And if we can know this, then at least we won't induce unnecessary suffering by grasping at them and overindulging in them. So this is the dukkha of change. And so we can understand that in our human experience, we have both unpleasant experiences and we have pleasant experiences. That's part of our condition that we find ourselves in. And to understand them for what they are. This is not something, I think, particularly unique to Buddhism. I think many spiritual traditions understand, and I think also through our own common sense, we can understand that if we have craving and attachment for pleasant experiences, we're going to suffer a lot. So this is not something unique. Whereas the third level, I think, is something a little bit more unique. And that is what's called all-pervasive dukkha. What this means is that underlying both our pleasant and unpleasant experiences, there is the simple fact that we find ourselves in a state whereby there's always a potential for some sort of suffering to arise in our life. That all pervasive means that we can't go anywhere and be anywhere to be completely free of the potential of suffering. So we are stuck in this all pervasive state, that there's always a potential for suffering to arise. Certain conditions come together, there will be suffering. And when we try to understand this, we can understand that the reason we're stuck in this state is that our mind is contaminated by the mental afflictions. That as long as we have mental afflictions such as anger and jealousy and craving and fear, anxiety, depression, As long as these mental afflictions are in our mind, we're stuck. And actually, many modern traditions say that this is the nature of our mind, that that's it, we're stuck. That you are in this state. But the difference here being, of course, is what the Buddha discovered was that these mental afflictions are not part of the nature of our mind, and that we can eliminate them and we can transcend. So this is how we are to understand this word dukkha, that our human condition is that sometimes we have unpleasant experiences, sometimes we have pleasant experiences, which are just stimulus-based, temporary pleasant experiences. They're both stimulus-based, temporary experiences. But underneath both of those is this all-pervasive dukkha, the fact that there's always this potential for some sort of suffering to arise. And so this is really pointing to the second noble truth. What is the underlying cause or origin of this state? So therefore, what we find sometimes is some translators, when they're translating this word dukkha, they don't use the word suffering to avoid this confusion. They sometimes translate that as unsatisfactory. So if someone were to say to you, according to Buddhism, all life is unsatisfactory, then you might think, oh, maybe that's true, let me think about that. But if someone were to say to you, according to Buddhism, all life is suffering, then we'd go, no, that's not true. Because for us, the word suffering is this. So this is how we are to understand the first noble truth, this truth of dukkha, the condition that we find ourselves in now. Any questions about any of that?
I have trouble remembering the third one and making sure I know what it means.
Right.
So again, it's like no matter what we're experiencing, at any moment it could change into suffering or something unpleasant.
I mean, what we can, sometimes this is translated as like conditioned dukkha. It's translated a number of ways, but I think this all-pervasive can really, if we can understand that all-pervasive just means potential, that there's always a potential for suffering to arise in our life, whether or not we happen to be suffering now or we happen to have pleasant experiences, there's always this potential here. And so I think this is pointing to why is that potential there, and it's pointing to the second noble truth, the fact that our mind is contaminated by these mental afflictions. So to really appreciate, I mean, this is pretty obvious, easy to understand that that's not satisfactory. And if we think about this a little bit, we can sort of understand that this also is never going to fulfill us. It's this one that really is the one, the key one. If we can really appreciate this, then we're really going to start to look within ourselves for the source of happiness and suffering rather than out there. So this is very important to try to appreciate. And to appreciate this, of course, we can also look at the second noble truth. So let's do that now. So in the second noble truth is the truth of the cause or origin of dukkha or suffering. And here, generally, two things are mentioned, two underlying causes. The first is the mental afflictions. In Sanskrit, this is klesha. And a klesha is defined as anything that agitates or disturbs the mind. And we'll be looking at these, of course, in the Lam Rim in quite some detail later. But Some examples of mental afflictions are anger and craving, jealousy, fear, anxiety, depression. All of these things really agitate the mind. And then within the mental afflictions, as we're going to see in the Lam Rim, there are some what's called root mental afflictions, the core mental afflictions that we really focus on. And there are a number of lists of those from 10 to 6 to 3, you know, like this. And here, what we're really going to focus on in the Lam Rim a lot later is the three core mental afflictions, which are called the three poisons. And the three core mental afflictions, the three poisons, are ignorance, attachment, and aversion. Sometimes here, instead of aversion, you'll see anger listed. The reason for that is that anger is a very strong type of aversion, very destructive one. So to really highlight that anger is very destructive and we need to pay attention to it, instead of aversion here, sometimes we have anger listed here. And ignorance here is a very specific type of ignorance. Because ignorance, in general, is just not understanding something, misunderstanding. But here, in the three poisons, we're talking about a specific type of ignorance. We're talking about a misunderstanding of the nature of reality. And here, within the Four Noble Truths teachings, this ignorance is really pointing to misunderstanding how we exist as a person. That now we tend to overinflate the sense of me. We grasp onto what's called in Buddhism self. Self here, which is a translation of the Sanskrit word Atman, self is a false, overinflated sense of me. Because if we look here, what's here? There's a body, there's a mind. Is there something more than the body and the mind here? Instinctively, we say yes. Instinctively, we believe there's something more than body and mind here. There's a third thing. There's this me here, this self. That this self, this me that we believe in, is something more than simply the body and the mind. And we have that in our language. We say things like, I have a body, I have a mind. As if there's this third thing, there's this extra thing, this me, that has a body and a mind. And so instinctively, in our behaviour, that's how we see ourselves. That, according to Buddhism, is a false sense of me. That's an overinflated sense of me. That's grasping to self. So, in the Four Noble Truths, this false sense of me is ignorance here. And because of this ignorance, this false sense of me, we end up with attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things. One thing we need to be clear about is that, as we're going to see in the Truth of the Path, is Buddhism says there's no such self. But no Buddhist school says there's no me, no person. We're trying to determine how do we exist. It's not a question of whether we exist or not. The question is, how do we exist? And here, what we're saying is that now, instinctively, we have a false sense of how we exist. We overinflate the sense of me. We believe there's this solid me here. We grasp onto that, and that is grasping onto self. So this is, in the Four Noble Truths, is the root of all of our problems. Because of this ignorance, we end up having attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things, and that these mental afflictions lead to all the other mental afflictions, such as jealousy, pride, fear, anxiety, depression, that all the other mental afflictions come out of one of these or a combination of them. So these are really the three core mental afflictions. And these were the three mental afflictions that were symbolized in that story about Prince Siddhartha. The Mara was ignorance. The daughters was attachment. The army was aversion. That these were the three inner demons that the Prince Siddhartha overcame. So these are the mental afflictions. From this false sense of me, we end up with the mental afflictions. That is driving our behavior. And so these mental afflictions are leading to our verbal and physical actions. Action in Sanskrit is karma. So here, what we are saying is that every action we do that's motivated by these mental afflictions has a result, has a consequence. And the results of our actions are our experiences of dukkha. And later, when we go into the Lam Rim, we're going to have a look at how this whole process works. How do we get from ignorance to the mental afflictions to our actions to dukkha? We're going to look at that in some detail later in the Lam Rim. But this is the very brief summary of the Second Noble Truth, that the cause or origin of our current state of dukkha is our mental afflictions, which are motivating our behavior, our actions, and then they are leading to our experiences of dukkha. So that's all I wanted to mention on the Second Noble Truth, because this is a huge topic and we're going to spend quite a lot of time on mental afflictions and karma and so forth in the Lam Rim later, but just a brief overview now. Anything there that's not clear? Yeah?
By self, do you mean like identifying?
What do you mean by identifying?
Like, this is my mind, so you say that I am unhappy. Do you identify with unhappiness?
That's something... No, that's another false thing we do. I'm going to talk about that also later, but there's a step before that. And the step before that is simply identifying or grasping onto that there is this solid me here. See, instinctively, we do instinctively have a sense that there's a me here that's something a little bit more than just the body and the mind. Intellectually, if we think about it, it doesn't make sense.
Is that ego?
Personally, I don't like to use the word ego because I think even in psychology, there are a number of different definitions of what that word ego means. So if I start using the word ego, then maybe there's five different ideas about what I'm saying because people have different ideas of what they've heard about what ego is. If I do use the word ego anywhere in my discussions, I qualify it and say, when I use the word ego, me, I mean this grasping onto self. But of course, ego may be defined in a number of different ways in psychology. I don't know. I'm sure it is. So that's why I don't generally like to use that word, because then people from understanding from different branches of psychology, they come up with their own interpretation of that, and then they misunderstand what we mean here. Okay.
I understand the teaching of no self, but I believe in the higher self, or the self with a capital S.
Right.
How do you deal with that kind of question?
Right. To really answer that question, we have to understand the view of reality, which I'm going to briefly introduce shortly, outside of the context of the Four Noble Truths. So I can't really answer that question now, and I think it will become evident later in the Lam Rim, because I'm going to spend a whole day on this sort of subject. I think the last full day and a half of the course, we're going to go into this in a lot of detail. But going back to the point over here about identifying, basically, if we identify with anything as me, that's ignorance. So, yes, we can use lots of words like big self, super self. Words are just words. We have to understand what do we mean when we use these words. And if the underlying meaning is that we're identifying with anything at all as me, that is ignorance, according to Buddhism. But what that really means, we're going to talk about. So yes, unfortunately, there are a lot of these words thrown around in a lot of the modern day traditions. And unfortunately, in different traditions, they use different words, or they use the same word to talk about different things, so it's just a minefield. It's really confusing. So what I'm trying to do is really go back to the Sanskrit and try to really identify what these words really mean from a Buddhist perspective, and then you can relate to them, you can relate these concepts to other words that you've heard and see whether they have the same or different meaning. Okay, so that's the second noble truth. Any questions, more questions on that? Otherwise, I'll briefly introduce the third and the fourth. Okay, I think that was all from the second one I wanted to mention. Yeah. So the third noble truth. Oh, one other thing is, while we're here, is this ignorance can be at a number of levels. Here in the Four Noble Truths, the ignorance is this, with respect to the person, is an overinflating the sense of me, grasping onto this self, grasping onto the belief that there is something more than the body and the mind here. There's a third thing, this me, that stands apart. But as we're going to see shortly, this ignorance can also come up at more subtle levels. And so we're going to look at how this ignorance is also operating at more subtle levels than just this. But that's coming soon. First, I'll finish the presentation, the overview of the Four Noble Truths. The third noble truth is the truth of cessation, the ending of suffering and its causes. So here, of course, we're talking about achieving this healthy state, liberation from suffering and its causes. And this state often is talked about using the term nirvana. Whereas the state we find ourselves in now, this state, this condition of dukkha we find ourselves in now, is often referred to as samsara. So what we need to remember is that samsara and nirvana are not places. This is not samsara. And when we go beyond samsara, we don't end up on this little cloud over the back of the hill in a place called nirvana. Samsara and nirvana are not places. They are states of mind. If our mind is contaminated by the mental afflictions, we are in samsara. So we experience this world in a certain way, we're in samsara. If we eliminate those mental afflictions from our mind, then we don't end up in some alternate reality. We're in the very same world. But now, because our mind is not contaminated anymore, our perspective is completely different of this same world. So then we are said to be in a state of nirvana. So again, samsara and nirvana are not places, they are states of mind. The difference being, samsara is a state we're in if our mind is contaminated by mental afflictions. Nirvana is a state we're in if our mind is free of the mental afflictions completely. So this is the healthy state, the goal we are striving for. Nirvana is personal liberation from samsara. But then also in the life story of the Buddha, we talked about the fact that Prince Siddhartha achieved enlightenment. So the question is nirvana and enlightenment the same thing? And the brief answer is, it depends who you talk to. And as we're going to see in the Lam Rim, that within what's called the Mahayana traditions, they're not the same thing. That nirvana is a stepping stone to enlightenment. What the differences are will become more obvious later when we go into the Lam Rim. So I'll just leave it there. So I'll just briefly say that nirvana is a stepping stone to enlightenment. What they really are and what's the differences we're going to cover in the Lam Rim. Any question about the Third Noble Truth? Again, just brief summary. Okay.
I have one question.
Sure.
My brain's working a little slow. So cessation is the end of...
Suffering and its causes.
Suffering and its causes.
Yeah.
Of which there are two, mental affliction and karma.
Right.
Which are actions that result from the mental affliction.
Right. Okay. So remember, it's the ending of suffering and its causes. Suffering here is dukkha. Causes is mental afflictions and actions or karma.
And the actions come from the
mental afflictions. Okay. So the process, which we're going to look at in some detail later, is mental afflictions are leading to our actions, which results in our experiences of dukkha. So if we want to overcome dukkha, we have to go back to the source. And within the mental afflictions, the underlying mental affliction is ignorance. So if we really want to overcome samsara and achieve nirvana, we need to get rid of ignorance. If we get rid of ignorance, that gets rid of mental afflictions, which gets rid of our karma, our actions, which gets rid of our dukkha. But again, the process we're going to look at in some detail. Yeah.
Does that mean that somebody who has attained nirvana engages in no actions?
When we talk about actions here, we're talking about contaminated actions. Yeah. We're talking about actions under the influence of the mental afflictions. So in that sense, someone who's liberated doesn't produce karma. But of course, someone who's liberated engages in verbal and physical behavior and actions. But that's not what that word is referring to. It's referring implicitly in the word action or karma is something that is motivated by the mental afflictions. The sort of the full thing is, if you want to have the full thing there, it's contaminated actions. So the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And here in the four noble truths, generally the presentation within the four noble truths is the noble eightfold path.
Okay.
And actually, we can briefly look at that. In one of your handouts, you have them listed. So maybe you'd like to get that handout out. It's the three vehicles chart, this one. So we can see, and we're going to look at this, we're going to touch on this chart a number of times in this retreat, and I want to go over it comprehensively on the last day of the retreat, because then we'll have an overview of the whole thing. But here, very briefly, we see in the first level here, which is called the Theravada vehicle, which I'll explain a little bit more shortly, is that the goal of the spiritual path is nirvana. And we can see that actually someone who's achieved this goal of nirvana is called an arhat. It's a Sanskrit word, sometimes translated into English as something like foe destroyer. So foe means enemy. So an arhat is someone who's destroyed the enemy. So of course the enemy is the mental afflictions, which are often called the afflictive obscurations, but we'll go into that later. And then here we see in the chart the practices. The practices is the path. What practices do we need to engage in to achieve this goal of nirvana? So here we see the Eightfold Path mentioned. And we see things like right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, right view, right thought. And when we look at these eight practices, they can be condensed into three main areas of practice. We see they're called the three higher trainings. So the first of the three higher trainings is ethics, or in Sanskrit there's sila. And so the three of the Eightfold Path, that is right speech, right action, of course here action means physical behavior. So speech is right verbal behavior, physical behavior, and then right livelihood in terms of our the work we do in our life. So these three things, of course, are subsumed into ethics, meaning having an ethical lifestyle. So, of course, this is the basis, I think, of not just all Buddhist traditions, but any meaningful life, any spiritual tradition. I think the basis is ethics. Then we have the second of the three higher trainings of concentration. Concentration in Sanskrit is samadhi. And so here we have right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration coming under this. When we talk about samadhi or concentration, we can actually talk about many levels of concentration that we can develop in the spiritual path. So remember in the story of Prince Siddhartha that many of the traditions at the time felt that if we develop higher and higher levels of samadhi, we can go beyond samsara. So we can talk about many levels of samadhi that are possible to develop. And often we can talk about nine levels. that we mentioned yesterday evening that often this concentration practice is called shamatha practice, because that's a particular level of concentration that we need to develop in the spiritual path, often simply called single-pointed concentration. So this is the minimum level of concentration we need to develop in the spiritual path. Above that, we have four levels, which are called the four dhyanas. Sometimes this is translated as the four concentrations. Here within the Four Noble Truths, which, as we see in this Three Vehicles chart, is the basis of the Theravada traditions. In the Theravada traditions, when they talk about this concentration practice, often you won't hear anything much about shamatha. In fact, in most of the Theravada traditions, when they talk about concentration practice, they talk about developing these four dhyanas. And then, higher than that, there are these what's called four samapattis, or sometimes translated as the four absorptions. And these are very high levels of concentration, but as the name suggests, our mind is becoming completely absorbed, so much so that we can't really use these minds for the basis of our wisdom practice. They're too subtle. They don't have enough ability to discriminate things. So in the spiritual path, shamatha and the four dhyanas are very good for the basis for the third of the trainings, the wisdom practice. The four samapattis, they're too absorbed. The mind is too absorbed to be able to then investigate the nature of reality. Of course, they're a very peaceful, pleasant state, but they're not a good basis for the wisdom practice. So generally, you'll find that within what's called the Mahayana tradition, such as Tibetan Buddhism, there's a lot of focus on just developing shamatha. Whereas in the Theravada traditions, they often talk about developing the four dhyanas. So all of those five levels are suitable basis for spiritual path. Any questions about concentration? And again, we're going to look at this shamatha practice in quite some detail later in the Lam Rim. How to do, yes.
So in practicing, you do need to go through the 9 step from samapatti down.
No, these are going up. So first, we're down here somewhere. Our mind is completely distracted and dull. So we have to go this way. So first we develop shamatha. That's all we need to do. I mean, if we can develop shamatha, we don't have to develop any of these to achieve nirvana enlightenment. If we want to go on to develop these, great. And these can be good to hang out in. But so, of course, you need effort to develop all of these. When Prince Siddhartha went out of the palace and he found these ascetics, they believed that developing these 9 levels was the way to liberation, that liberation was at the top, that if you went right to the top, you'd be liberated. But he and Prince Siddhartha developed all of these 9 levels, but he found that the very high level was, of course, a completely peaceful, blissful state, but that when he came out of it, he was still in samsara. He wasn't liberated. So what he understood was that concentration alone can't liberate. You need wisdom to overcome the mental afflictions. That concentration, all that can do is sort of keep the lid on the mental afflictions. But they're still there. It doesn't eliminate them. To eliminate the mental afflictions, you have to develop wisdom. That's what Prince Siddhartha discovered.
So what's the point of the samapattis?
The samapattis, a couple of points. One is that, of course, they're a very peaceful, blissful state. But also, what you find when you go into more detailed text on the concentration practice, if you develop these, then you can get into very fancy concentrations where you're mixing a lot of these things, which can help to with the mind. But the actual, when you're in this state, then it's too absorbed to be a basis for the wisdom practice. But developing them and then mixing them can help to really also stabilize these as well. There's a whole big discussion about all this sort of mental gymnastics. But
what stage do you develop the superpower you can see future past?
Yeah.
Which one?
Yeah, which one? I want that one. You want that one?
The four.
The first of these four.
Oh, okay.
The first jhana is said to be the basis for developing what's called these super normal abilities.
Why not?
Then, of course, the third of the three higher trainings here is wisdom, or in Sanskrit, prajna. And here that's corresponding to what's called right view and right thought. Here, this wisdom practice, often we have a similar Sanskrit word of vipassana. Or probably most of you are more familiar with the Pali word vipassana. In Sanskrit, vipassana, Pali vipassana. In this word, the vi means higher or beyond. Passana or passana means to see. So vipassana or vipassana practice means to see beyond or higher seeing. Often translated into English as special insight or simply insight. So when we talk about the wisdom practice, then often we hear the term vipassana practice or vipassana practice. So often then in the Mahayana we hear about shamatha and vipassana. Or in the Theravada, developing the jhanas and then vipassana practice. And here again, within the Four Noble Truths, the wisdom practice that we are particularly focusing on is this wisdom realizing no self. Selflessness of person. Again, no self does not mean no me. No self means to realize that the person, the me, does not exist in this overinflated solid way which we normally think that it does. So we grasp onto this solid me called self. That doesn't exist. We believe it exists, and grasping onto it is leading to all of our mental afflictions and suffering. If we can come to realize there's no such self, we can overcome mental afflictions and suffering, we can achieve the goal of nirvana. But again, this wisdom practice, we're going to spend a lot of time in this later in the Lam Rim. But any questions about the Fourth Noble Truth now before I move on? The grasping onto self, one of the implications of that is we see ourselves as quite independent. And a result of that, and to answer this question better, we have to talk about another concept which I'm coming up to very shortly, is that that leads us to believe that there in fact is this world out there that's the source of our happiness and suffering. So grasping onto self predisposes us to getting caught up in the eight worldly concerns. If we can eliminate this self-grasping, there wouldn't be any eight worldly concerns, because we will realize that there's the source of happiness and suffering is not out there.
Okay.
So this is the Four Noble Truths, and this was sort of the idea that was most widely taught at the time of the Buddha. But also in a place called Rajgir, the Buddha and Rajgir is not that far from Bodh Gaya, where he achieved enlightenment. And he spent quite a lot of time in this area of Rajgir. There, he taught a more subtle idea. He taught the idea that there is a subtle, more subtle level of ignorance operating than just simply grasping onto this self. And what he taught here, in what's called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, of course, one of the most famous Perfection of Wisdom Sutras is the Heart Sutra. What he taught in these teachings is that he taught the idea of emptiness. Which in Sanskrit is shunyata. What he basically said here was that even though there appears to be an independent me here and an independent objective world out there, these appearances are deceiving us. The world does not exist in the way it appears. There is no independent me, no independent objective world. This is what emptiness means. Emptiness means nothing exists independently. Emptiness does not mean nothing exists. It's saying that everything is empty of independent existence. Why? Because everything is dependently existent, or what's called dependent arising. So he said here that there's this deeper level of ignorance going on, that we're also at a deeper level grasping onto this subject-object duality, that there is this me here and the world there, and that we need to eliminate this ignorance to go beyond samsara. But also here, in these teachings, he taught this idea of bodhicitta. This idea that we can not only achieve personal liberation from samsara, that we can achieve the goal of nirvana, personal liberation, but rather we can go on to achieving full enlightenment and become Buddha. And so this idea of bodhicitta is this aspiration. Citta is mind, bodhi is enlightenment. So bodhicitta is literally the mind of enlightenment. So bodhicitta is this aspiration for enlightenment. Why? So that we can help liberate everyone else from samsara. Because if we can go on to achieve full enlightenment, then not only will we eliminate all suffering and its causes, but we'll fully develop all the positive qualities as well, and thereby have full potential to help liberate others from suffering. So here, these teachings talk about a deeper level of wisdom and talk about the further goal of enlightenment. And these sets of teachings then form the basis of what's called the Mahayana traditions. Any questions about this? Again, this is a very brief introduction, and we're going to be looking at both this idea of emptiness and this idea of bodhicitta in very much detail later in the Lam Rim.
Any questions?
Sure.
It kind of struck me that we go in emptiness from non-duality into bodhicitta that's dual. Isn't it us and them?
So what we need to appreciate is non-duality doesn't mean we all become one blob. You know, like example, this is an easy one. Is this big?
To an ant.
Yeah.
It is big?
Relative.
Yeah. So big only exists relative to small. You can't have big and small, can you? Impossible. So duality is grasping onto big and small. That's what we do now with ourself and the world. We believe there's a me here and a world there, independent, instinctively. But our self-grasping, grasping onto the belief there's a me here and an independent world there, that is exactly like saying this is big. It just does not make any sense. You can't have a me in isolation. Me can only exist relative to not me. What that not me can be you, the world, whatever. But you can only have me if there's not me. Just like you can only have big if there's small. But now we don't realize that. Intellectually, we can sort of maybe appreciate that. But is that how we're behaving? No. We're behaving as if there's a me here and a world there. We're behaving as if this is big and this is small. It does not make any sense. So realizing emptiness is realizing there's no big and no small. There's no me independent, no independent world. But that realization of non-duality, is that realizing that everything is one? No. One means the same, identical. Is big and small one? Are they identical? No. Are they different? No. So they're neither same nor different. Because same and different is dualistic thinking.
Yeah.
Isn't it? So when we come to realize emptiness, and then the question here is, in bodhicitta we have the aspiration to help others. When we realize emptiness, it's not like we all become one big blob. It's not like big and small become one thing. They exist relatively. So now, of course, we believe there's a me here and there's them there I need to help. But if we realize emptiness, we will realize that the me who's helping them are interdependent, not independent. So this is going to come. I'm going to talk a lot about this. Anything else about this? Again, this is just a very brief introduction. These two things are huge topics. And we're going to spend a lot of time on this in the Lam Rim in this retreat.
I don't know if I'm getting ahead, but are these three separate vehicles or are these three stages?
Good question. I was going to answer that later, but I'll give the brief answer now. Is that they are three levels of practice. So, you know, often people look at these, you know, the last one there we haven't looked at yet is Vajrayana or Tantra. And then people think, oh, which one should I choose? Should I do this one, or this one? Oh, that Theravada Mahayana stuff looks like a lot of work. This Vajrayana Tantra stuff looks really exciting. I want to do that because it promises me the result immediately. That's for me. That idea is exactly like saying, I want the third floor penthouse. That's what I want. But don't build me the first two floors. I don't want those. That's what we need to understand. That Tantra Vajrayana is the third floor penthouse. If we want that, we have to establish the foundation for noble truths. We have to build on that with these ideas. Then we can effectively build our third floor penthouse of Tantra or Vajrayana practice. So yes, the answer is these are levels of practice. And this becomes very evident, obvious in the Lam Rim. Even tomorrow when we look at the overview, it will become evident that these are levels of practice. Okay. So let's have a look now at how Buddhism spread after the time of the Buddha. after the time of Buddha, I mean, during the time of Buddha and after the time of Buddha, the teachings that spread most widely in India were these Four Noble Truths teachings. Because this idea here, the emptiness idea, was very profound, and this idea of liberating everyone from suffering was immense. So for many people, they couldn't really appreciate these ideas. But, you know, the idea of personal liberation from suffering, a lot of people could sort of appreciate that. So this is what was spread most widely. And then after the time of the Buddha, as Buddhism spread, then it spread through an ancient language called Pali. And initially it spread to countries like Sri Lanka. And then it spread up through the northeast into Burma or Myanmar, as it's now known. And then further into Southeast Asia, into Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and so forth. So it sort of spread that way. And the teachings here that spread were these Four Noble Truths teachings. So in these traditions, when they go back to the original text, they'll be written in the Pali language, and the goal of the spiritual path here is nirvana, personal liberation from samsara. So these traditions now are often referred to collectively as the Theravada traditions. Whereas these teachings, these Perfection of Wisdom Sutra teachings, very profound, difficult to appreciate, they weren't so widely taught. And it took quite a number of centuries before they really started to be more widely taught and practiced in India. And at that time, then, they were mainly using the Sanskrit language to transmit these teachings. And at that time then, Buddhism spread up through the northwest of India, which is now modern-day Afghanistan, Pakistan, and went up over the Himalayas onto the Silk Route, and then it went across the Silk Route, initially into China, and then from there into Korea, down to Japan. And then down into Vietnam, so it sort of came down that way. And then, at a later time, we haven't looked at yet, but we'll look at briefly later in the Lam Rim, this idea of Tantra or Vajrayana, the highest level of practice, only really started to develop, become more prominent around the sort of 6th, 7th, 8th century. By then, Buddhism had spread already to all of these countries. And these teachings here, of course, are based on this. And so these traditions now, the Sanskrit traditions, are called the Mahayana traditions. Yana means vehicle, maha means great. So sometimes it's called the great vehicle. It's the vehicle that can take us to the great goal of enlightenment. So all of these collectively are called the Mahayana vehicles. And then a little bit later, as I mentioned, in India, around 6th, 7th, 8th century, as Tantra or Vajrayana really started to gain momentum, that's when Buddhism then spread over the Himalayas again into Tibet. So it came initially into Tibet around the 8th century. And initially it came into Tibet through two great Indian masters of Padmasambhava and Shantarakshita around the 8th century. And through their efforts to establish Buddhism in Tibet, we have the first of the four Tibetan schools forming. Which is the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. Nyingma means old school or original school. And when we look in the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, the main approach to practice that's mentioned there is called Dzogchen. Shortly after this was established in Tibet, a king came to power in Tibet who didn't like Buddhism and tried to wipe it out. So for a couple of centuries, sort of Buddhism went a little bit underground in Tibet. And then around the 11th century, another wave of Indian masters came over the Himalayas into Tibet. And initially, one of those great masters, particularly related to this Lam Rim, was Lama Atisha. In early 11th century. And Lama Atisha really introduced two systems of practice into Tibet. The first is this Lam Rim structure, which we're going to be following starting tomorrow. Lam is path, Rim is stages. So this is the stages of the path to enlightenment. And he introduced this by writing in his very famous text called Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment. And so this is the foundation then of this Lam Rim approach to practice, which we're going to be following. But also Atisha is very famous for introducing a system of practice in Tibet called, in Tibetan, Lojong. Or often translated into English as mind training. And on the basis of these systems of practice, we have a lineage of practice developing in Tibet called the Kadam lineage. Around the same time as Atisha, we have other great Indian masters coming into Tibet. In particular, there was just prior to this, great Indian masters, Tilopa and Naropa, who were presenting the what's called the Mahamudra system of practice. This was then brought into Tibet through the great Tibetan translator, Marpa, who then, his most famous disciple was Milarepa, often considered to be the greatest yogi in Tibet. And then Milarepa's main disciple was Kampopa. And so what Kampopa did was he took these oral Mahamudra instructions and synthesized them with Lama Atisha's Lam Rim instructions. And as a result, we have the Kagyu school being formed. And within the Kagyu school, of course, nowadays there are a number of sub-schools, and I think a number of you have heard of the Karmapa. Karmapa is head of one of those sub-schools, what's called the Karma Kagyu school. So the Kagyu school, therefore, their main system of practice is Mahamudra. Which is quite similar to the Dzogchen approach. Both are very much nature of the mind type practices. Also around about the same time, we have another lineage of practice being introduced into Tibet, which formed the basis of what's called the Sakya school. And that system of practice in Tibetan is called Lamdre. Lam is path, as in Lamrim. Dre means result. So Lamdre is the paths and the results. Then what we have is this Kadam lineage that was following on from Lama Tisha, using a lot the Lojong and particularly the Lamrim structure. Around the 15th century, then we have Lama Tsongkhapa, who really expanded on these Lamrim instructions and wrote a number of very decisive texts, one of which is one we're going to be following. And so through the efforts of Lama Tsongkhapa, we have then the Gelug school being formed. And the main system of practice in the Gelug school, of course, is the Lamrim, the stages of the path to enlightenment. And so, starting tomorrow, we are going to be using one of these texts from Lama Tsongkhapa, particularly his most extensive text called the Lamrim Chenmo, the great stages of the treatise on the path to enlightenment. So these three schools collectively are often referred to as the Sama schools. Sama means new school. Nyingma means old school. So this established around the 8th century. The new schools from the 11th century onwards. So these are the four main schools within Tibetan Buddhism. And we're going to be following the Lamrim structure in the Gelug school, particularly this text from Lama Tsongkhapa. So any questions on that before we... I think it's just about time for lunch.
Is the Kadam part of the Nyingma?
No. What we find is that the Kadam lineage, elements of this have been integrated into these various here. So I think you'll find that particularly this Lojong system of practice, mind training, there are a number of texts in that area, particularly two famous texts called the 7-point mind training and the 8 verses of mind training. And I think you'll find, because they're very practical approach to practice, this is, I believe, taught pretty well in all of the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. So you'll find teachings on Lojong in all of these schools, whereas these are their sort of core practices. But particularly Lojong system of practice can be a good, can be a good support for these types of practices. Because there are certain elements in the Lojong system of practice which I think can be extremely beneficial in our modern day society. One of the really the strengths of Lojong or mind training is this ability to see all conditions as conducive conditions, i.e. to see even the most difficult situations as opportunities to progress in the spiritual path. This is one of the big strengths of Lojong practice.
So is the Lamrim specific to Mahayana, or does Theravada use Lamrim as well?
So this Lamrim structure was brought into Tibet from Lama Ratisha. He really developed it. Of course, if we look at all traditions, they will have some sort of structure to their path.
Okay.
So, but when we say Lamrim, we're talking about a particular structure.
Okay.
So what that structure is, we're going to look at tomorrow morning.
So would this be considered number 4 of the Noble Truths because it's part of the path? Or is the path only 8-fold noble? 8 noble truths. Or I mean the 8, sorry.
So remember the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path, is presented in terms of achieving nirvana, personal liberation. Whereas these, all of these schools, of course, are within the Mahayana. So all of these systems of practice are describing methods to not just achieve nirvana, but to go on to achieve enlightenment. So they have a lot of elements there. What we're going to see, and that comes up with the question before about are these different vehicles or levels, what we're going to find in the Lam Rim is that the foundation levels of Lam Rim, the practices, are more or less identical with the practices in the Theravada traditions. How they're packaged with different names and so forth, that can vary, but the actual core practices are the same. Okay. Anything else about this? Otherwise, it's now, I heard the gong for lunch. Okay. What we're going to do each day at the end of the morning session is I'm going to give some discussion topics for you to go into your discussion groups at 2 to 3. But since today we have to first divide up into groups, we'll do all of that at 2 o'clock. So just for today, at 2 o'clock, come back here. I'll divide you up into groups and then also give you some topics to discuss. After today, starting tomorrow, what I'll do at the end of the morning session before 12 o'clock is I'll give you the topics and then you just go off at 2 o'clock to your group. So you'll be in the same group the whole time. And then also I'll tell you at 2 o'clock where you can go to for your discussion groups, okay? So let's leave that till 2 o'clock. So we can break for lunch now, have some lunch, have a rest, and then we'll come back here at 2 o'clock.